Osiris.
Hey, this is Brendan from Umphrey's McGee. This podcast is part of the Osiris podcast family. Osiris is a growing community of music and culture podcasts, connecting music fans with conversation, commentary, and of course, lots of music. Osiris works in partnership with Relics Magazine.
Osiris.
Hey, everybody. It's the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is episode 145. This is RJ. I'm here with Matt. Hey, Matt.
Ho, ho, ho.
I'm here with, and Jonathan's here as well.
Hey there.
It really took me by surprise. I have good news. We've been reporting on Brad's whereabouts recently, and I'm happy to report that he was actually here at my house this weekend. And he's alive and well and in person. We hung out, and now he's back with his family. So he's taking a night off from hanging out with me. So you guys are going to have to live with us. But we do have two awesome guests, both of whom have been on the podcast before, but not together. And we're hoping that they don't yell at each other too much, but it might happen. First is Drew, who's at Drew Fish on Twitter. What's up, Drew? How you doing, man?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And our other guest is Chris, who's at Chopaganda on Twitter. Hey, man.
Hey, how's it going, RJ? Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Jonathan and I had the pleasure of meeting Chris for the first time at the fiasco that will not be named. We had an RV
somewhere party. In the vicinity of New York.
We had an RV party, and it was really fun to meet you in person, although I thought it would have been better to meet you at a concert.
I mean, Bucky Buckingham's campground. You can't really beat that, can you?
You can't.
I got a great dinosaur mug that day, so it's totally worth it.
I mean, they had mini golf, they had a pool. What more could you want?
It actually was pretty. It was a fun night. But man, okay, we'll just move on. we're about 3 weeks away from the New Year's run at MSG, and I think December always makes all of us think of specific tours, whether it's, December 97, December 99, and maybe a couple others. But this conversation started on Twitter, as many great Fish conversations do. And I believe that someone tweeted something about December of 1995. And I don't know if you remember, Drew or Chris, where it started, but things kind of picked up from there. So I made a note to come back to you guys when December came around so that we could talk a little bit about December of 95. Drew, is that something, do you remember how it came together, or is it just something that you're often thinking about?
I've probably tweeted that it's the greatest month in Fish history about 900 times. So yeah, I'm quite partial. I saw 11 of the 17 shows, and yeah, it's spectacular. It has absolutely everything. And I go to it more frequently than any other period of Fish. And that's been true since January of 1996. So it was like, as soon as I started getting tapes, I've just been hitting them hard. So yeah, it's wonderful music.
That's awesome. 11 of 17 is impressive. And Chris, you I know saw a bunch. I saw you tweeting yesterday about the 12-9 show, but I know you have lots of thoughts on this month, which we'll get into in more detail. But what's your sort of overall take on it now?
I mean, there's really two types of Fish fans out there. There are those who realize that December 95 is the best month of Fish ever. And then there are those Fish fans who are either hearing impaired or not very good at Fish. And that really kind of sums it up. Unlike Drew, I only saw six of the December 95 shows. So I was very much a noob at that time. And that month solidified my fandom.
Wow. Thank you for breaking that down so simply. I hadn't thought about the two different kinds of Fish fans, but now I know. Yeah. It's useful information.
it's a very good litmus test when you meet new Fish fans.
It makes total sense to me. I've been advocating the 1295 for a long time. I only saw two of them, but after I was done seeing 1295, I didn't bother seeing him again till 97. So I learned my lesson.
You did.
Missing 96 wasn't the worst thing ever.
Yeah, no. I spent my time well.
So. Guys, so okay, we laid the groundwork here. So in 95, there was, I mean, a lot of things were happening in the fish world. Obviously there's a lot of new music. They were playing bigger venues. We've talked about that before, here, but what was it about the sound before we get into the specific shows to you guys that, that make it, you know, that make the month so special and important? Drew?
Well, first of all, it was at the end of a long tour, and that always, at any point, I think it would be phenomenal. And I know that we're never going to hear this because they're in a different place life-wise. And I used to tour half the year with my classical brass quintet, and I get it. Like, I'm not interested. I don't care who asks me to go on the road, even if they're heroes of mine, I'm not doing that ever again. But it would be fascinating to see them play this many shows in a row, you know, go for like 2.5 straight months with 1 week off in the middle. But the December 95 has got, I mean, there are phenomenal segues. They're the power that they played with in 95. It was kind of like the raw power of 94, but just a little bit more refined, which isn't the best word, but a little bit more controlled. But they had a gear and then another gear and then another gear on top of that, that like no rock and roll band that I've ever heard, certainly any improvisational ones have ever had. It was amazing. There were, as we're going to get into, there were some shows where the set list construction was not exactly what I was looking for. I saw 4 mid second set Son of a Mules in this month of, which is just like, it that oh like it's at least it's really long. It's just it's and yet I literally floated out of all 4 of those shows. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. the highlights of every single one of them were just like there were fireworks.
If you know, I think I know the word that Drew's looking for. So the thing about December 95 that makes it so special is it has that next level improv, that skill, that depth that you have in August 93, that you have in fall 94, that you have in June 95, but it has this accessibility in the sound that just, it's something you can easily get into. Like for, you know, something like the big summer 95 tweezers, the Fleezer and the Mud Island Tweezer, are absolutely amazing jams, but I need to be like by myself on headphones. And I'm not sure how much I'd want to see those again in the live setting. I mean, now I'd love to see them in the live setting, but I'm talking like back in the day when you want something you can more like sink your teeth into, dance to, kind of like groove to. December 95 combines like this next level improv, this amazing skill, this amazing speed with this really accessible sound that you don't have to work incredibly hard to get into.
Yeah, we talked on, I think it was the Tweezer overview that we did a couple of years ago, how it seemed like summer 94 through summer 95, they were really trying to push the jams as far as they could. And that resulted in some, for lack of a better term, almost non-musical segments sometimes where they were just sort of making a lot of rhythmic sounds and they weren't concerned about that because they wanted to push through to the next threshold. But fall 95 seems like it's where they had the confidence and the know-how to keep pushing, but as a group get to the next very musical section.
Right.
Would you guys agree with that?
Exactly. That sounds great description.
This is where the improvisation kind of really became and consistently became group composition. Mm-hmm. At the same time.
Yeah. Great. The other word that I really should have used before was patience. The fact that they have the power that they had and the ability to make the roof blow off of any building within 2 minutes of any jam starting, and the patience that they exhibited over and over and over again, whether it was Antelopes or Bowie's or Hoods or Melts or Mike Songs or, I mean, everything. They're just like they let all of the jams breathe. And even though we knew where they were going and they knew where they were going and we wanted them to get there, they took their time. It's just perfection.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like a 90, like 97, and man, I'm in a really bad position right now in which I'm knocking 97. It's not like 97 where they would find a groove and they would be patient and they would let it breathe. This was still that incredibly impatient, not a wasted note fish, where like there was no downtime in the jams, but it combined that incredibly impatient, no downtime jamming of 93 and 94 with that always that musicalness that you've got post 95.
Yep.
Yeah. Definitely. And the kind of mix between the patience and then when they are just like the tweezers from this month are just, they're so high energy and they're so fast, and the bathtub gins, they never let up. But at the same time, you hear so much patience. It's cool. And that was a band, like I think one of you guys said, at the top of their, you know, abilities. I just want to say that, you know, we're about 10 minutes into the episode. And if those of you who follow Chris on Twitter are probably wondering, if we're going to do any conversations about, you know, looking at this month in any way in terms of how we organize them, or if we're just going to kind of talk through the shows. But so Chris, can you tell us, we're about to talk about one of the most, you know, revered months in Phish history. So shouldn't we just say that all these shows are great and not bother with, you know, ranking them and having gaps and tiers and all that? Don't you think?
Boy, did I just get set up here. So, yeah. So if anybody, so for those who follow me on Twitter, it's kind of become a joke, a monster of its own, the Phish rankings. And, you know, there's always the question, well, if music is subjective and it's a personal experience, why do you rank? Why can't everyone just listen to the shows and just enjoy it for what they are? So we're going to go back a little bit, and we're going to talk about what it was like to be a Phish fan before you had live Phish downloads, before you had electronic file transfers, when you actually had to put a little effort in order to get some new live Phish music.
Should we sit on your lap while you tell us this? Or?
Drew, you are allowed to sit on my lap, but nobody else.
Thanks, Joe.
Can I rub your tuba while we do that?
Absolutely. I don't know what that meant, but let's just keep right on moving.
This is a family program, guys. Come on.
So back in the day, you know, the typical tape trading is first you would exchange tape lists with somebody else, and you would look at that person's tape lists and you would see what shows they have and what quality of shows they have. And then you would say, pick 10 tapes off of this person's list. That person would pick 10 tapes off of your list. You would dub them, send them in the mail. You kind of had to, you wanted to know what were the good shows, what were the bad shows. That's why it was incredibly important, well, important in the Phish sense of the world, not in the world view sense of the world, to know what shows were the better shows, what shows were the weaker shows. Like, the last thing you want to do is, you know, you're getting a bunch of fall 95s from this guy who's got most of the tour.
And you pick California.
Exactly. I was just about to say, you pick Cal Expo off his list, and you pretty much just wasted a tape right there.
Yeah, but the Dead were good there in 90, so must be good, right?
Sure. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and the Grateful Dead were famous for this. When they put out the big hardcover Dead Bass book every year, one of the most important areas of that book were the list of best shows of the year, best versions of every song. And it was a way that you could figure out, well, what was good, what was bad, and you could amass it. So then people will say, well, what's the difference between a tier two show or a tier three show? Or, you know, what makes this show better than this show? And there really is no hard and fast rule. You know, in the end, the music is subjective, and whatever you love, you love. But I think it's, you know, one can probably say that, well, you know, to someone who is completely opposed to ranking, what is the better show, New Year's 95 or First Night of Tahoe from this summer? It's a pretty easy question. So, you know, then you start thinking, well, what makes one show better than the other? And as you listen to more and more of Phish's music, you start hearing, you know, the subtle differences between each show, the combination of, well, what shows have the better setlist construction, what shows have the bigger jams, and you can kind of formulate a general idea of, you know, what shows are better than what shows. Now, does this mean that everyone has to agree? Absolutely not. But it's a good guide if you're diving in the Phish's music to understand, well, what were the shows that people thought were great? What were the ones that people thought sucked?
I guess I just want to maybe defend the entire concept of art criticism, which just seems like it can sometimes, people will indirectly disparage any criticism of art at all. And I just don't, I've at this point, I think I've recorded somewhere, I don't know, 10 or 12 albums or something like that through my career. And if you were to listen to every single one of those, and then you were to tell me with a straight face that you liked every single one of them exactly equally, then that's just telling me that you didn't really listen to it very much. I mean, there's no chance that you're going to like all 10 of those, because they're all different. And even Fish shows are quite different. I mean, it's just me buzzing my lips into a tuba mouthpiece. I mean, there's not a lot of, and there's a lot of different variety of what the music I'm playing, but you know, I mean, it's so, but I also don't think that like a truly woke fan of Monet needs to say that they like every single painting that Monet has ever done equally. And that to, and I just wish that people would understand. And also it's okay to say that Monet, that there were a few paintings in his career that really pushed some boundaries for that were a stretch for him, and that really pushed boundaries that really affected other people. Maybe other artists commented on a specific painting that he did, etc. I just don't. And sometimes there's this unspoken thing, especially on the internet, which is, you know, I never issue hot takes. They're always very thoughtful and, you know, and well laid out. But, you know, the internet, it can kind of like, and I also, it's cool if you want to just like everything. Like, that's fine. I really don't think that you need to decide one's better than the other. The problem I have is that when you then turn it around and when people go the, well, you should give your tickets to somebody who really, you know, who really likes the band. That just, that makes me
want to. Fuck every
just,
one of those people.
That makes me want to bang my head against the desk. So I just, so I appreciate people who are really big fans of things who can, I think in a smart and an intelligent way can comment on what they like more than other things and then why they like that and then defend it. And you don't have to agree with it, but I'm just wanted to take a brief moment to defend art criticism in general.
Well, we know that you you walk the walk, considering that you did tell Trey that he was playing Mike's song wrong. So
I told him more than once too. So yeah, that's
good. Repetition is the key.
Yes,
well,
it is.
I just want to say I wish that Brad was here, because he has such a strong take on Monet that I think you guys, like, that could have really gone on.
There you go.
In a lot of different directions. But sorry, Chris, go ahead.
Monet ranked. and I want to just throw one other thing, is that by nature, if you're going to say that this is one of the better shows or this is one of the best shows, then that means that there needs to be worse shows or worst shows. You can't have one without the other if you're putting these in order in your brain. If something moves to the front of the line, something has to move to the back of the line. And, you know, what's kind of interesting is that when I do the rankings on Twitter and I go back and I rank older shows, people seem to appreciate it a lot. Mm-hmm. When I rank shows during a tour, it starts Firestorms.
Part of that's because we have so much, we have recency bias is a thing, right? It's a theory and it's something that happens. It's also like, because of the constant communication and the rapid pace of it all, like we're talking about it an hour after it happened and everyone's opinions are just different than
some of us just literally spent hundreds of dollars to have that experience. And we want to go ahead and pretend it was really great for just a few weeks.
Sure.
That's fair.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have, in fact, I said on our last episode, I think, that we don't rank things. So I want to thank you for coming on here to do that for us.
we're very, very dedicated to
I
our
believe that
statements.
The actual quote was, we don't tear shit around here.
So nope. I think that's about right. Yeah. Thank you.
I almost drove off the road. Yeah.
So, guys, this is going to be a two-part episode. We're going to start, and Chris and Drew took the lead on this ranking. Can I attribute it to both of you? True.
This was all Chris. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you don't want to claim any of this, do you, Drew?
Well, I did say on email that if he had gotten cute with what the top show was, that part two was going to be me flying to Denver and kicking his ass on live on the podcast. But he didn't get cute with it. So, in my opinion, some people might disagree, but so I approved that part. But anyway, no, this is all chop.
So Chop, we are going to start, we're going to go work our way backwards. Part one is going to cover the first, you know, tranche of shows, and part two is going to cover the top shows. And this shook out into seven different tiers. And did you start with a particular number of tiers in mind, or does it sort out as you go?
No. All right. Do you really want to know the method behind the madness?
If I mean, is there a white paper?
Do we?
So, the method really what it came down to is, when you guys asked me to do this, the first thing I did is I looked at all the set lists for the month of December. Most of these shows I've listened to 50-100 times. Some of them I'd only listened to maybe like 5-10 times. So the ones that I hadn't listened to a bunch, I went and I re-listened to them. And then I started breaking them up in the groups. And I found that there was a clear number one show that no other show I thought was even on the same level at. So that's tier one. Then I found that there were two shows after that. I couldn't decide which was better, but I knew that there were no other shows that were better than those two shows. So those shows were tier two. You know, same process for tier three, tier four. Finally, when we got to tier seven, there were three shows left. And I really could not figure out how I was going to order those three shows. So they all got lumped together in tier seven. And the general idea of the tiers is that the shows within the tiers can be organized in any direction you want. There's not a lot separating them. But to jump a tier, you should have a really good reason that a show from tier seven belongs in tier six.
Got it. Okay, cool. That's helpful. That's actually really helpful. And I hope that doesn't give away the secret sauce, but you know, you can't recreate the masterpieces. So we're going to start with tier seven because we want to hear of these shows, and there might be some surprises for people out there who listen to a lot of fall and winter 95. So let's start with tier seven, Chop. We have the first one here, 12-4, which is the first night of UMass Amherst, and one that Drew may have gone to.
That is one that I went to.
So what landed this in tier seven, which again doesn't mean that it's a bad show, but in terms of the highlights versus what wasn't so great. And I should say to the listeners, we are going to have some music in here throughout. So, you know, we will reward you.
In my mind, when you compare this show to the rest of the month, it is still a fantastic show. And if they drop this show sometime in 3.0, it'd be one of the better shows of 3.0. But it's just rather unremarkable for the month of December 95. You know, and even with an unremarkable show, I'd still say that the Antelope is fantastic, probably a must listen.
Yes.
The You Enjoy Myself is outstanding, and the You Enjoy Myself actually plays on some of the same themes from the big Rosemont 90 Halloween 95 You Enjoy Myself. First set, there wasn't a lot that jumped out at me. Maybe Drew wants to dissect the show further.
Stash, which this wasn't one of the, it wasn't the strongest stash of the month, but all four or five of the stashes in the month are all should be heard. So that was great. But yeah, largely it just kind of went through the motions, especially considering the time.
So I think Jonathan is going to try to fight someone over the internet about the next one. Okay. I was really trying to set up some drama here, but what another show that made it into tier seven is 12-15, which is the only show of the tour from Philly, which I think some people like. Jonathan, do you have particular reasons why you like the show?
Well, I was there, of course, but I do like the show. I mean, it's,
which feeds right into Chris's whole theory.
Yeah, well, no, being there is obviously generates a propensity toward bias, of course. But it was a lot of fun. Set two opens with Tweezer Reprise into Jim, rather. The Bathtub Gin is unique and has this another rotation jam, which I'd seen earlier in November in the tour, with this one-time-only Weird Fishman moment singing the song called Mallory, whatever the hell that was. It was bizarre. it was bizarre. Great Possum, by the way, ended the first set. I love the maze.
No wonder.
Yeah, just get out here, man. Come on. I'm going to fight you over Possum one of these days. Cool. It's going to be awesome.
Possum in 95 was serious.
Yeah, that's true. Serious.
Yeah. They're all blistering.
10/22/95, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but that possum, if you have not heard it, your jaw will be on the floor.
Right.
Maybe the best possum ever.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, these guys, they were on fire. Everything was good in this time frame, at least good, you know, even if it wasn't as good as all of the other shows in that month. I think this one still floats really high, and so I love it. I don't necessarily argue the ranking because I can see what all the rest of the shows are. But yeah, I think this, if anything, it goes to show how good this month is, that that this show can be in the lower tier.
Yeah, and it's okay if I crush your dream. If I crush your spirits,
you can have your own opinion.
Okay, so
please crush Jonathan's dreams.
Okay, so first off, this is kind of a little fun for me to talk about this show because this show holds a very special place in my heart. This was the first Phish show that I ever attended that I walked out of not feeling satisfied. So it is the birth of my jadedness.
What?
You know, and
wow.
You're wow, we have this show to blame for this?
We have this show to blame?
This should be tier 8 all by itself then.
So
that pushes it up at least two tiers because of its importance.
Here's the thing. The set list looks like a dream set list. It is so incredibly fun, but you have to remember that you're comparing this show to the rest of December 95 that has so many amazing jams, and this show doesn't have a single jam that holds up versus the rest of the month. And, you know, if this was on any other tour, you can maybe excuse it, but not on this tour. I mean, the Harry Hood is the weakest Harry Hood of the month, probably by a decent margin. What else do we have? The Possum's great. Every Possum in 95 was great. The Runaway Gem is good, but it is far from great. It's far from one of the better versions of the year. It's Ice in the middle of the second set when you still haven't had a great jam is kind of a soul crusher. The bathtub, the bathtub gin, you think that something is going to start, something good is going to start happening. And call me crazy, call me old-fashioned, but when I'm already jam-starved in a show, I'd like to see the guitarist keep playing guitar, the drummer keep playing drums, the keyboardist keep playing keys, and instead we got a rotation jam. You know, and the music
that was my
came
second
out of it
rotation
was
jam.
Kind of nothing. 2001, they were all standard back then. The Bowie is one of the probably the weakest Bowie of the month, if not equal with another show from this month. So there's nothing to really sink your teeth into. And I can't believe that I've been put in a position that I'm ripping on a show that contains two Tweezer reprises.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, they played Tweezer reprise twice. So there we go.
Yes.
You should give your tickets to someone who actually likes the band.
Yeah. I know. That's what I'm saying.
Bro.
This was only the second set opener Tweezer reprise ever. The other one was at Meriwether this summer, which is crazy. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know what else
to
say.
And that was the other one was Good Times, Bad Times into Tweezer reprise. And I thought that shit ripped. So I'm sorry, Chop had a bad night.
You know, it did. Listen, it ripped. And
the
I
birth
had
of jadedness.
It ripped and I had a great time. But when I got out of that show, there was nothing I needed to go back and hear again.
It's sort of like the birth of
that's kind of how I judge shows. I mean, is there something that I want to go back and hear again?
I want a bootleg copy of this, like a CD bootleg with, instead of the birth of the cool, the birth of the jadedness with a picture of you on a chop. I feel like that would be like, I'd put that on my shelf. Sorry,
I will add on a personal note that, I didn't see them again until 97 and, I didn't get back to Philly for a while for Phish, but, the next morning after this show, my girlfriend had morning sickness and puked in the elevator. And then we rode back up to the room so she could freshen up before brunch, some folks got on the elevator and stood in it. It was amazing. It was just an amazing moment.
Was she sick because the bathtub gin went into a rotation jam instead of actually jamming?
No, my daughter Althea was inside her gestating.
I missed that part.
Oh, well, that's not funny.
Yeah,
so way to go, man.
Yeah.
Maybe Althea was ahead of her time and she was upset at the bathtub gin dissolving. No,
Althea really didn't like that it's ice placement.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, that kid's been known to have some bad opinions.
So, so guys, the other show that falls into tier seven, surprisingly, one of the tapes that I remember getting in the spring of 96 or early 96 is 12/30/95. Part of the New Year's Eve run, of course. Great Hood, but maybe, I guess, in your opinion, Chris, otherwise sort of not terribly remarkable in light of December 95.
I mean, this kills me to have to do this because unlike 12/15, which I wasn't thrilled, you know, I knew there wasn't great stuff going on in the moment. I was at 12/30 as well, and I loved this show so much. I think The Hood is just a masterpiece. It's probably the third best hood of the month, but it's still an absolute masterpiece. The wind down from The Hood that segues right in the bag is amazing. But you know, the Antelope is an unremarkable Antelope for 95. The Bowie is an unremarkable Bowie for 95. There's no big type 2 jamming anywhere in this show. And you know, there's that big old Scent of a Mule right in the middle of the second set. So as much as I love this show, and as much as I wore out the tape, you know, I just got to be honest about it. And Drew, I'm curious if you agree with me on this, because I saw recently that you were just listening to this show and having some fun with it.
Yeah, the Hood is spectacular. But again, a broken record. I'm going to make the same point like 20 times. If you edit out 18 of them, I understand. But it's like, that's just, it shows you the strength of the month when there can be a jam that is as strong as The Hood, which is an absolute all-timer of a version of Hood. And I was doing a deep listen to that, like, I don't know, like a week ago or something. The homework for this episode was awfully fun. But that Hood, yeah, you're right that there's just such, this is similar to making like a, trying to make a list of like the 20 greatest players in NBA history. Like there, you have like absolute mega superstars that like defined their city's sports scene for a decade and a half that are like at 18, you know, I mean, but that's because you've got like, you've got Jordans and you've got, Birds and Magic Johnsons and like, you know, the top is the top. So yeah, there are some holes here. I really had a great time. You know, nothing compared to the next night, of course, but yeah, I do not disagree with where you have this ranked.
Yeah. And I just want to throw in that The Hood, which, you know, just says that this is, as Drew said, this is one of the all time great versions of Hood. And I have it ranked as the third best Hood of the month. And that just shows you how well they were playing that song in fall 95.
Yep.
So I don't think that the next night, 12/31, is tier seven. I think it appears later on, which we'll get to eventually. but we do jump a tier here with one of my favorite tweezers of 95, the 12/2. That's the first show in tier six. And I guess, sort of notable enough jam that it jumps a whole tier?
Yeah. I mean, the best way to look at it is that there are no big monumental jams in those tier seven shows. Mm-hmm. There just aren't any. They're great shows, but there aren't. Once you get in the tier six, you start talking about shows that have more to offer, especially more to offer on replay. And, you know, God damn it, does that New Haven tweezer offer a hell of a lot on replay. You know, that tweezer in my mind is one of the most, if not the most ferocious jams the band has ever played. I put it up there, right up there with the Prague 98 Ghost. There's maybe a few others. The PNC 2000 Gin is one that I think about, as far as songs that go type two, and they're just so driving so hard. Even though this show, you know, the Reba is actually nothing to kick aside. So definitely give the Reba a listen. But there's not a lot to this show beyond that tweezer. So, but it's enough to elevate it here.
You guys just like dinging shows with Caspian openers, isn't it?
This is true.
I did notice that. Yeah. Yeah. And also 1211, Trey with the big, like, we're going to play this really, really special thing. And then it's like Prince Caspian. It's like, oh, for the love. Are you serious, dude?
Trey has always loved that song.
Things have changed a lot, you know, these
days. Worst thing is that Prince Caspian was evil, even more awful back then than it is now.
So
yeah, it had that like weird slow build opening.
Jesus.
Yeah, dragged out.
Like another 4 minutes. This tweezer is outrageous. Drew, were you at this show?
I was not at this show. I sure wish I was. Yeah, that tweezer is one of the most powerful things that the band has ever done.
12-2-1 may have been one of the ones that we included on our big tweezer retrospective as representative of 95. Just the intensity that they're playing. There's a point in there where it sounds like they just get shot out of a cannon. And I'm trying to think of other examples from their entire career where it sounds like that. And it's not some sort of like, you know, gradual build or something like that. But it's just like, I don't know what happens. They don't even look at each other because there's video of it. You can see just all of a sudden they just like Fishman starts playing Double Time and they're just like going nuts. It's really representative of the tempos, the entire fall. It's everything is like the tempo is way, way, way up and they never lose their cool. They never go off the rails. It's amazing.
I like the Prague Ghost comparison because I think that's the highest energy Trey I think that exists, but this is up there. It's wild. And so that's one. Yeah. So that kicks it up. I agree with that ranking. Then you go to two shows actually that round out tier six and that close out the December part of the tour before the New Year's run, which are 12-16 and 12-17 from Lake Placid. Did you guys go to either of those?
I was at both of those.
I was not at either Lake Placid show.
Yeah, there was something remarkable happened in the beginning of set two, the sample in a jar. Well, that was not remarkable. Although that does remind me that the first time I ever saw a show with Charlie Dirksen, this was in Portsmouth, Virginia. I can't remember whether it was 11 or 2012, but we had been friends forever. First show we ever see together, and the band comes out and opens with Sample in a Jar, and Charlie flipped the bird to the band really angrily and then sat down and started checking his email, and it was awesome.
That's incredible.
Yeah, but what during Trey's sample solo, you hear him stop. Some fan threw a t-shirt at him that actually like hooked over the neck of his guitar. So he had to stop and rip the shirt off and throw it. And he was really pissed. It was just kind of like a mood. And then Always Money, that third slot Son of a Mule in the set two, which was after, the weird sample opener. And yet the Mike's simple Week of Pog is really, really fantastic. But it just, things were just a little bit off this night with some great highlights. Yeah, some really great highlights. But the Mike's Groove in particular is fantastic.
Yeah, again, this is kind of like why I had this show a tier above, which is that even though it's far from one of the best shows of the month, that simple Week of Paw is a must here. The simple segues straight in the Week of Paw. It's
magical.
You know, great. Yeah, pure great transition. And then the Week of Paw is absolutely fantastic. And then if you go to the next night, again, it's a bit of an up and down show, but the Hood is downright spectacular. I have that one as the second best out of the month. And then the Tweezer reprise, the close, again, absolutely spectacular, like every other Fall 95 Tweezer.
Yeah, that's and also the Stash, the Stash and the Antelope from the first set are both really fantastic. Listen to every single Stash from the whole month and you'll be happy. But I remember that this 12-17 set one was one of the best side A's of any first set tape I had, which was the Antelope Mango Tube Stash, which was just like a phenomenal and blistering versions of Antelope and Stash. And the Tweezer segues into a Page solo that's almost like a Squirming Coil solo, which then he drops straight into the reprise, and that's what closed the final set of the tour, which was great.
Do you guys think, because at this point, so the band had been on the road almost, I think almost 3 months at this point, right?
Yes.
Yep. So, Drew, do you think like at 12, 14, notwithstanding, which was the, what, fourth to last show, but these last few shows, do you think they were getting toward the end of the line? You think they needed a little break? Or do these two shows just happen to, I don't know. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if they were, if they saw the finish line. Yeah, I don't care how nice the hotels are. I don't care if people are doing the driving for you. I don't care if you're a rock star and everything's done for you. The road is hard, and I don't need anybody to keep me in their prayers because I got paid really well to travel the world playing the fucking tuba for a living. I mean, that's like a miracle, right? But it does, it just, as I put it, I was on the road for 14 years. I don't know if I said the number before, but like the way that I describe it is like, you know, the Colorado River didn't make the Grand Canyon overnight. It's just like every day there's just like a few more grand, and it's just, it's hard. It's really, mm-hmm. really difficult. And that's why you're away from family and you're just away from just the, you know, the comforts of home. And I have definitely, sometimes the end of a long stretch of touring is the hardest one. So I don't, of course, we don't know that they were tired, but I could kind of see them. And they sure as hell were rejuvenated by the time the New Year's run hit. I mean, those were, those four shows were, they hit the ground running there. So, but again, flashes of brilliance at both of these shows.
I think that's a good, you know, I never really thought of that, which is that, you know, Philly and Lake Placid closed the run, and, you know, for as brilliant of a set list as Philly was, you could start hearing that they were running out of musical ideas. So yeah, maybe this was a sign that they needed a little bit of a recharge.
They'd definitely been leaving pretty much nothing on the table. They were just throwing everything out there right up to that. You know, we talk so much about December, and understandably so, but there's still so much other great stuff earlier in the tour that, you know, it's a miracle these guys had any gas at all by the time they even got to this month.
Yep.
It's a wild tour. I mean, it's so, the tour is so dense and so awesome. It's amazing. So we're going to, that's tier six. So we're moving up to tier five. We're going to take a quick second to hear about a couple sponsors.
We're excited to have Simple Contacts as a sponsor once again. We love to have these companies that solve tasks for us, and this is one that solves the complicated process of getting contacts that I've talked about on previous episodes. If you wear contacts like me, you know that you have to get a new prescription each year just to buy more contacts. Simple Contacts is changing all of that by using technology to make renewing your prescription and buying more contacts super simple. Using your computer or phone, you take the online vision test in 5 minutes from anywhere like your couch. If you're waiting on your couch, maybe watching Couch Report before a fish comes on, you can do the test then. Then a real doctor reviews your test in 24 hours and writes you a prescription. And then, boom, a fresh supply of contacts is on its way. So no more appointments, no more waiting rooms, no more overpaying, etc. As an HF Pod listener, you can get $20 off of your first order. If you want to save $20, go to simplecontacts.com/HFPod or enter the code HFPod at checkout. I do have to tell you that this is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. You're still going to want to see your doctor periodically to get all of the range of tests that they usually do when you go to see him. But this is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and reorder your contacts if your vision hasn't changed. So try it out while you're waiting on your couch before the Couch Report starts from the upcoming Madison Square Garden shows and get $20 off. That's simplecontacts.com/HFPod or use the code HFPod at checkout.
We're excited to talk about a new sponsor this week, Kushco. Have you seen those amazing containers that cannabis comes in these days, like the cool plastic tubes for joints or the glass containers for concentrates or the edible packaging? There's a revolution happening in packaging, and Kushco is an industry leader in this. They create packaging to adhere to guidelines and to stay safe and innovative. And we want you to check out what they're up to at kushco.com/podcast. Cushco Holdings is a publicly traded company under the ticker KSHB and the parent to a bunch of other innovative cannabis industry leaders. And they've sold more than a billion units to more than 5,000 dispensaries, growers, and producers across North America, South America, and Europe. So they're doing a lot, but they're also sharing a lot of their learning and sharing a lot of their innovation on their website. So again, go to cushco.com/podcast to see all the really cool stuff they're doing. And we appreciate them being a sponsor. All right, guys, we're getting into tier five. So, Chris, I'm curious about this because I saw my first show in October of 95 at the Palace, and this next show, 12-8, was one that Brad actually went to and a lot of my friends, but I didn't make it to. Why did this one jump up a little bit from the ones we've talked about thus far?
Okay, so you're talking about 12. We're on 12-8 now?
Yeah.
Cleveland.
So, you know, it's kind of funny. This was one of the ones that, one of the tapes that I did not wear out back in the day. And I thought this was going to be a little lower on the rung versus at the other shows. And then I threw the tape on, and the 2001 Tweezer Kung Tweezer segment is so damn good. And then go the reprise into Antelope again, so damn good. You get the Beatles Double Down for the encore for John Lennon's birthday. John Lennon's death day.
The opposite, but still a day.
For his death day. You know, and then you look at the first set, and you know, the Runaway Gym is, you know, it's solid if not spectacular. The Fluff Head is played to perfection. You know, maybe I didn't notice that Caspian was played this night, or I would have dropped it a tier. but just in going over the shows, I just thought that you know, the construction of the show, especially the second set, combined with the strength of the Tweezer, the strength of the reprise Antelope, and then the Double Down on the Beatles encore, had the count for something and elevated above those three shows. Elevated above the previous tier.
Yeah, this is also a show that I did not wear out back in the day. I was not at this one, but yeah, upon re-examining, I also think it's better, and it's obviously overshadowed by the next night, and also, yeah, I think the fact that it's overshadowed and also that it was one of the ones that I didn't make it to, you know, I'm much more likely to, especially then without having the benefit of, I was much more likely to get a tape of a show that I was at, of course. And I did get this second set, but didn't wear it out, but that wasn't necessarily a rational decision in retrospect.
Are there any rational decisions in Fish? I mean,
no. You know,
all of my decisions are rational, and all of my takes are thoughtful.
Yeah, we could probably do an entire podcast on all of the horrible things that I said back in 95 and 96 and 97. There's really no rhyme or reason.
Tomorrow.
Anyway, moving on. There's the other show in this tier also has a Caspian, which I see a theme developing here, at least at these tiers. This might be surprising to some people because I think this show is one of the most well known, probably because of some of the antics, but 1211 in Portland, Cumberland County Civic Center. There's an fish.net describes the Bowie, which I think we're going to listen to a little bit of, as haunting, ghoulish, and riveting, which I completely agree with. But this show, Chris, this show is, I think, pretty highly regarded by folks. And again, not saying that it's not here, but why did it fall here?
You know, I'm going to be honest on this one. I sort of have some regrets, and this show should probably be one more tier higher. You know, but at the same time, you know, I'm just going to go back to it, which is that the month is so damn good. You know, this show, it's the Bowie is fantastic. It's the best Bowie of the month. The Hood is great. The Reeb is great. But then you've also got that big old scent of a mule in the middle of the second set. You know, this was one of the tougher ones to place because it doesn't necessarily have the same amount of meat that the shows above it have, but at the same time, it's still just an absolutely fantastic show.
This one is a really hard one for me to be rational about because this is one of the most fun shows I've ever attended. My number one tune that I was chasing at that point in time was Tube, and they were only playing it once a tour. And I had I saw six or seven shows in October, and then I had these 11 lined up. And so, you know, I still probably wasn't going to catch it, but I had a decent chance. And then they played it in Austin, like, you know, a week before I started the tour, and I cursed loudly in the library at Northwestern University when I saw that. And then they dropped it, and I absolutely, when I got home to my parents' house, I was home from, you know, on break, I actually busted into their room at 2:30 in the morning, and my mom sat up, she said, "How was the show?" And I said, "Mom, they played Tube." And then I ran, then I ran to the other end of the house. So, yeah.
Awesome.
And they're good parents. So they were like, "Oh, good for you, honey." And then she went back to sleep. So, but the dog log stuff was just, I mean, it was just like all-time epic antics. I actually had a chance to ask Trey about that a couple of years ago, one of the times I talked to him in Nashville. And I asked him if he remembered the dog log album, and he actually lit up. And I was with Don Hart, and he immediately turned to Don Hart and started explaining to him, you know, about... he was talking about how everybody was booing the band and screaming, "Oh, you suck." And like, and he was just like, he was absolutely elated. The band was just having such a blast. The Warren Haynes, this was before it was cool to bash everything that Warren Haynes does on Twitter. And the Warren Haynes stuff was just unbelievable. So yeah, this one, and again, listen to the stash. But yeah, this one, it's impossible for me to separate just the music from my experience. Because my experience, this is a tier one show from the almost 200 that I've seen. So yeah.
And you know, I think as we get to the shows that are the tier hot tiers that are, sorry, the shows that are at the tiers above this, it'll start to become clear why, as great as this show is, it's not necessarily a tier, a tier one, tier two, tier three show for the month.
I would like to respond to something that Drew said. It's true. Warren Haynes was getting a lot of love on Twitter in this time.
You know, Warren is actually the reason I think why this tape circulated so heavily. Mm-hmm. It was such a big deal that Warren sat in with Fish that this tape circulated like wildfire.
Well, I mean, for context,
collecting
was the, you know, he was still with the Almonds in that first run of the Almonds, and Government Mule was a new thing, and it was a hot new thing, and some of us were really, really jazzed about it, and but we're old enough that we say things like jazzed about it. You know?
So we got Drew's take, having been in attendance on all the antics that night, because I would definitely call this an antics-filled show.
Sure.
Chris, in your mind, do all of the antics help or hurt its case?
Ooh, I think I think if I was going to weigh the antics more heavily, it would be ranked higher. And I think if I was going to weigh the antics less, it would be ranked lower. Because if you don't weigh the bust outs and the antics, you're really looking at a very good Bowie, probably the fourth best Harry Hood of the month, and a very good Reba, but not the best Reba of the month. So like the month is just so damn good that as Drew said, we're just going to say this over and over and over, that, you know, I think with the antics are what keeps it where it is.
Okay.
The month is so good that I literally woke my mother up at 2:30 in the morning over a tier five show.
So maybe we could, while we're talking about that Elvis thing here, maybe this is the moment where we could just comment on the fact that the Suspicious Minds Fish performances from this tour with the cape and the lights inside the cape were absolutely hilarious and a lot of fun.
Agreed.
Did a Suspicious Mind, did that push things up a tier? No, I'm just kidding. You don't have to answer that. But I had a lot of fun seeing that song.
So guys, we're gonna start the next tier, tier four, at the end of this, the part one of this, and then we're gonna pick that up next time and go into the rest of the shows. The one that's gonna fall into this category, and again, I think you said, Chris, that within tiers there's not necessarily a ranking, so this seems a little bit arbitrary. But the last show we're gonna talk about tonight, at least, is 12-5, which is the last night of the two night Amherst run.
Cool. This show is just one of my favorite shows. I think it's one of the more under the radar shows of the month. The audience tapes of it are absolutely gorgeous.
Yes.
And, that was probably a big reason why I fell in love with this show early, is that my tape just sounded so pristine. The big highlights here is that the Bathtub Gin is a 24-minute absolute monster. And at the time the gin was played, it was the first or set the either the best or second best gin ever, depending on what your thoughts are on Murat Theater 81393. And it pretty much was a top three gin until the song really opened up in 97. And even to this day, you could probably still make an argument that it's a top 10 version. Beyond the gin, the Harry Hood is, in my opinion, the best hood of the month. And it's also my personal favorite version. I'm not going to argue that it's the best version of the song ever played. There's the Fall 94 kind of runaway freight train versions that are just so damn good. The Alive One version, 10-20-94, Kent State. And then you have some of the 2003 versions that open up, get Type 2, and get really out there, like Camden 2003, I believe it was Charlotte 72503, Vegas 21503 got out there. But as far as being just a perfect example of that song with just incredible phrasing and an incredible peak, it's tops for me. And then I didn't even get to the Bowie of the first set, and the Bowie is another must hear version.
There's also a great "I'm Blue, I'm Lonesome" in that first set.
the gin is outrageous. Drew, do you feel similarly about this show?
I do. In particular, the gin and the hood. And I bet if the Bowie was in the second set, again, this is back to the days of tapes, so I had the first set and I did listen to it, but the second set was like never far from my tape deck at all. The hood actually is what I play for any professional drummer that wants to hear Phish. Is that's the thing. And I've been threatening to write a blog post for Phishnet for a long time, like for long enough that it's probably never going to happen. But where I talk about, like focusing, like choosing a jam to focus on just Paige from the beginning all the way to the end, and one for Trey and one for Fishman and one for Mike. And, there are a number that I have in mind for each of them, but this would be the jam that, and actually there's a number of them from the Week of Pog. From New Year's is another one for Fishman. That's one for all four of them. But this hood is just Fishman. It's unbelievable. The power and the finesse and the patience and the sustained energy. And as Chop just said, the phrasing, it's easy to play loud. It's not easy to start softly and to have, like, this hood is basically like just one gigantic crescendo. And to do that is, it's not just physically demanding, but mentally demanding. I don't care if you're playing classical music or you're a jam band or you're in a jazz combo or whatever. Just having it's really hard to do that. And this band, because they had all those extra gears, they had more gears at their disposal, I would say, than at any time in their history, for this month. It's maniacal, his playing. And that gin, yes, is, again, it's 24 minutes. I just listened to this on the anniversary in preparation for this, and it's a really special jam. It's quite unique. It's not a typical gin, but it's just a fascinating musical conversation. And the other thing that I was struck by just in general for this month, that is true of every single show of this entire month, including the lower tier ones, is that all of the composed stuff all is just executed nearly flawlessly. Yeah. I mean, and there are the Squirming Coil from New Year's is maybe I think that's the most interesting jam that's ever happened. The conversation between Trey and Paige in that is just spectacular. The reason I'm bringing it up is because Trey absolutely chews on about 30 seconds of composed part of that Squirming Coil because he wrote songs that are just ridiculously complicated and he just kind of got over his skis and whatever. But if you listen to like the lizards from this show or the opening horn or really any of the composed stuff from Bowie, it's not just playing the right notes at the right time. If you think about music as music is like speech and notes are like words and then phrases are like sentences and then, you know, you get bigger chunks that are paragraphs, etc. It's not just putting the words in the right place, right? When Siri or Google Assistant talk, it's starting to sound freakishly good, but in general you can tell it's a computer. The flow isn't there, and just the flow of everything, even as I think it was Matt who talked about the elevated tempos for the whole month, like the flow of absolutely everything. All the pickup notes lead directly to the downbeats. All the weight is the same of all the, I mean, there's just so many layers of it, and just the execution of all of that type one stuff is just, it's just magical. That's a band that's at the height of their powers and also has been playing these tunes for 2.5 straight months and sound checking. And that's back when they, you know, none of them had kids. They you know, lived, breathed, and shat fish. I mean, that's all they did all the time. You know, that's quotable. But I just wanted to throw that in at some point during these two episodes that all of that stuff was just otherworldly.
The way it sounds like they're just daring each other to play faster and faster in the composed pieces.
Yep.
It just blows me away every time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. And I noticed that too, going back to these shows. Not that, you know, I hear a lot of flubs in 3.0 because, you know, I don't hear many at all. But, you know, if you listen to these, you might hear a little bit tighter playing. It's pretty remarkable.
And if I could comment on that a little bit, because I've been there, any professional musician has been, depending on what it is. But some of these songs are so difficult and they don't play them that often. That's the other thing, is that you look up, like at one point I looked up how many Bowies they played in 94 and 95, just those 2 years. And it's well more than all Bowies in 3.0 combined.
Oh yeah.
And so just the number of reps and then how compressed those reps are. But when you have to focus like that hard, it's the opposite of being in a flow state. In a flow state, if you're, you read The Inner Game of Tennis, and like a great tennis player is not thinking about how they are holding the racket and how far back the racket goes on a backhand, et cetera, when they're competing at Wimbledon. I mean, that you do all that work. You don't just like through osmosis learn how to play tennis. But you get into this flow state, and a lot of the stuff nowadays, you can tell that they are concentrating so hard to get through it, at least at times, and it can be a different person each time, that there's not the level of communication that was happening before, where at this point in history, in December 95, somebody could just change a little thing. It could be a note length. It could be an accent that was added or taken away or whatever. And the whole band would react on a dime because, again, all of this stuff, even the complex stuff, was in this flow state. And there's a lot of different terms you can use for that. And when you are using your conscious, mind to have to think about where to put the fingers and et cetera, then you can't, by definition, be also reacting and interacting with the other people playing at the same time on the same level. And that's really, I think, the difference that we hear. So a lot of times, even when they hit the notes now, you can tell it's just not nearly as clean, which is the easiest way to put it. But the tone isn't as good. It's not as pure. It's the flow of the lines is not there.
There was one thing you said in there, Drew, that was one of the big takeaways for me as I listened to a lot of stuff from this month over the last couple of days. And that's the reaction of all the band members if something goes wrong. They all jump on it very, very quickly to the point where, you know, and now I feel like if something happens, it's almost like, all right, how do we get out of this gracefully? Whereas right. Back then, they definitely saw it as an opportunity. There was one, and I can't remember what show it was. There was a Yamar where they completely botched the ending. Trey played that last the last chord, and Fishman just kept the beat going for some reason, and you can tell that it was a mistake. But instead of, you know, Trey kind of probably, you know, giving Fishman a dirty look and saying, okay, you know, play four and then, you know, play four measures and then stop or something like that, he started chanting something. And then, you know, you hear like, you know, Mike come in with a line or something like that. It's like every, you know, off script moment is an opportunity. And it takes an unbelievable amount of concentration, like you said, to be able to jump on those.
What's that? What's that gag about a Prince? The line about Prince, where is if he played a bad note, he'd play it again, and it would become a right note.
Yeah. Yep.
That's why it's nice to be Prince.
Yeah,
it is kind of, you know, when you listen to these older shows, it's not that they nail everything every time. It's that when they miss something, they power through it. Mm-hmm. And you know, now when they miss something, they sound tentative around it. And you know, I'm far from a musician, so I'm not going to dissect it too much. But you know, when the band only plays a limited amount of shows per year and doesn't practice together that much per year, you know, you can't expect them to play like they used to.
Right.
The last thing I'll say is that, you know, I'm always preaching to my students that there are two punctuation marks that you can play any note or any phrase with. One is a question mark, which the goal is to never play with a question mark ever. The other is an exclamation point. And that becomes very difficult when the muscle memory isn't there, when something goes wrong. If you are consciously noting that it's not going correctly, then at that point you are not issuing commands. Trey's guitars are beautiful. They are stupid. They don't know whether it's going well. It's not going well. Trey's fingers are stupid. They don't know whether it's going well or not going well. It's all in the brain, and you have to be issuing statements and commands. And so when you start to analyze, and boy, it can be really hard to not be thinking like, holy shit, this is not going well. So you don't need to be in front of 20,000 people to have that. You know, I've had that experience in front of a couple thousand people, and it's not a fun experience. But if you can, when you're really in the zone and have a swagger about you collectively, when it's not going right, you just ignore that. And I always tell my students, you have to allow the next note or phrase to be the greatest thing that you've ever played in your life, no matter what the hell just came out of your amp or your tuba or your voice or whatever. And nice. That's easy when it's easy, and it's really not easy when it's not easy. And at this point in time, I think that they had a swagger about them. You know, there was exclamation points. The soft stuff had exclamation points. Everything, slow, fast, everything except for the mid-second set Son of a Mules, which can die in a fire.
And the Caspians.
Well, I just want to put an exclamation point on this part of the episode. No, sorry, that didn't work. But Jonathan, Son of a Mule is still not great. But
what?
So, guys, we...
Why do you gotta point your bad opinions at me? I'm feeling attacked.
So, guys, this has been really fun. So we have another set of shows to walk through in part two of this episode. But this has been really fun. And Drew, who's at Drew Fish on Twitter, and Chris, who's at Chopaganda on Twitter, we really appreciate you guys joining us for this. And it's amazing that we've only made it halfway through December, but we've already heard and talked about a shitload of good music. So excited for what's to come. So thank you guys for doing this and putting it together.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And if you guys haven't yet, give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. That's helpful for us. And if you see Brad, send him back to us. We'll see you guys in a little while with part two. Keep on rocking.